Stocks Update for Saturday, February 24th, 2007. Welcome to Tax Update for Saturday, February 24th, 2007. This week, credit denied, the IRS attacks partnership state tax credit shelter. The Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm what is raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and supporting documents may be reproduced freely as long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the podcast. Such prohibited use to include using the podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Again, you can visit them on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. This week, we're going to take a look at an IRS recently issued chief counsel advice that goes into a discussion about another partnership tax shelter the IRS was not terribly thrilled with. And we're going to take a look at it this week for a couple of reasons, mainly because it gives us a good reason to discuss some of the issues involving partnerships and how they relate basically to the code and to other entities, and some of the special rules that people try to work with when they design these shelters. Now, not so much because you should probably be going out and designing shelters. That may not be the way we're going to be looking at this. But because these special provisions do come and arise and become important when you have taxpayers who are conducting themselves in a partnership form or who have elected as an LLC to be treated as if they were a partnership form of business. Now, this particular transaction was an interesting arrangement being marketed that involves state tax credits and partnerships that promoters claimed essentially allowed a taxpayer to produce some real interesting magic. They could recover virtually all their initial investment via reduction of state income taxes through a state tax credit they would receive, and then they'd be able to take a capital loss deduction that effectively shifted the expenditures from state income taxes from below the line to above the line as a capital loss. That was kind of interesting if you had alternative minimum tax problems that were going to disallow any deduction for the state income tax to you otherwise. And we did all this with, you know, basically not, you know, so there was no out-of-pocket cost effectively, and we magically got our state income tax deductions moved up as a capital loss deduction. And you may wonder how that worked. Well, so did the IRS, and in a memorandum, they outlined a number of reasons why they claimed it did not work. Now, as I said, we're studying this for a couple of reasons, both looking at the reasons why the promoters thought it did work, which lets us discuss some interesting provisions in the 700 series of the code, as well as discuss the reasons why the IRS says, wait a minute, guys, I don't think it works this way. And that gives you some ideas about some of the issues the IRS has and some of the arrows they have in their quiver to be able to go against various tax shelters that are structured in a partnership arrangement, or at least arrows they believe they have that can shoot down these options. And as I note in the printed materials, I've got kind of a personal reason for looking here. I've gotten my list pretty much of the CPE courses I've agreed to go ahead and give lectures on in the coming year, and I found that I'm going to be doing a few partnership ones in that group, so it's one of these issues now suddenly partnership items catch my attention a bit more than they used to. So I've got a few of those coming up. Now, the IRS memorandum in question, and this is Chief Counsel Advice 2007-04028, and that memorandum outlines the basic shelter being promoted. Now, there was an issue. There is a state not mentioned in the document specifically, but there was a state that had a tax shelter that basically had a tax credit. And like many states appear to be doing these days, there are a number of states that have enacted credits that essentially somebody who's not using the credit, quite often these credits are enacted to, let's say, encourage out-of-state companies to come in and do things. For instance, Arizona has one designed to encourage out-of-state companies to come in and do movie production in the state of Arizona. Well, one of the hitches is, in a case like the movie production credit, the taxpayer in question may not have enough Arizona income tax to realistically be able to absorb this credit they're being given. So what the state has allowed them to do is sell off the credit to other investors. Well, the state in question in this ruling had allowed these credits to be sold. Now, these were credits involved with basically rehabilitation expenditures. and these rehabilitation expenditures credits could be sold. Well, the state decided down the line that, well, they didn't like that result. So they removed the ability to sell these credits, but they did allow them still to be reallocated if you were in a partnership. So the credits still existed, and if you were a partner in the partnership, then we could allocate credits specially to different individuals, different investors. So this became an issue, and this was the situation we were facing, or the promoters were facing. So what they designed was, hey, you know, we need a partnership. And you know what? If we're going to have a partnership, we can kind of make this work so that the investors get a little bit extra out of this in a partnership deal. And, you know, we really should have thought of this before when we could have sell them. We could have done this other thing, is their theory, because, hey, this is magic. And here's what would happen. A new partnership would be formed that would join with the partnership of the developers of the projects who had these excess state tax credits they wanted to get rid of. The investors would buy into the partnership paying a fixed dollar per dollar of credit, a fixed amount per dollar of credit that was going to be allocated immediately to them upon making the payment. As soon, you know, the new partnership allocated the state tax credit to the individual investors who would use the credit to reduce their estate income taxes. Now, the IRS points out that generally the investors in these partnerships didn't care about the state income tax deduction because for various reasons, probably primarily the alternative minimum tax, they did not see a tax benefit from the state income tax deduction. So whether or not they paid state income tax or didn't pay state income tax would not change their federal tax obligation. So they really thought it was irrelevant in this purpose. The investors would execute, therefore, a subscription agreement that indicated they anticipated the release of the receipt of the credits. Once the agreement was executed and they paid the cash over, the credits were immediately allocated to the investor. And if there were any additional credits that came up in the project in the short term, they were allocated within the next few months. In a very short time period, the individual had received all of the credits they were going to receive under this program. In essence, they had no other real rights under this program, and so at this point, somewhere shortly after all of this, they would sell their investment back to somebody, apparently normally related to the promoter, for a fraction of their original purchase price. And amazingly enough, they would say, you know, they would not, the agreements provided the investors would not receive any material cash distribution from the partnership, nor would they share in the results of sale of the projects. The claim tax credits were the only benefit they would receive. Now, on the final sale, they would claim, though, I had paid $10,000 for this. You know, I got my credits, so I got, you know, I got, let's say, $9,900 worth of credits, so I have all my credits, now I've used my credits. And now I sell it back to the promoter for, you know, $100, and I claim a $9,900 capital loss because the allocation of the credit under their theory did not serve to reduce my loss in any way, shape, or form. Because essentially what would happen is we'd receive the state income tax credits, gave me back mostly all of my original investment. No tax benefit from the state tax deduction was there before, therefore there was no change in my federal taxes from the use of these credits. And since no partnership items that affect basis were allocated to the partner, when we sell back our interest to the person related to the promoter at our fair value, which now is essentially zero, we don't have any real right except to get the credits. We already got the credits, so now these interests really have no rights. Who would pay anything virtually for them? When we sell them back to the promoter, we now, though, get a capital loss because our basis never changed, just the value of the interest dropped down to virtually nothing. Now, if you had the right situation entering these transactions, let's posit the perfect situation. I have a large short-term capital gain. I have AMT situation that's impacting me, so I'm already in a position where state income taxes aren't going to help me in terms of additional deductions. So I have a short-term capital gain I'd like to offset, and I have state income taxes I'm not getting a deduction for. Well, by executing this agreement, I'm going to transfer the money to the promoters. I'm going to use that credit to pay the state income taxes. So that's kind of a wash. My out-of-pocket stays the same there. However, now I turn around, and because I then have a capital loss when I sell back to the promoter, my decrease in value, or what I saved in state income tax, essentially drops down and reduces the value of the partnership interest. Now when I sell this back to the promoter, I have a capital loss. So what I have really effectively done was transferred my state income tax deduction above the line and got to use it to offset my short-term capital gain that I was going to pay taxed ordinary income rates on. And isn't that wonderful and great? And isn't that a perfect scenario? Why does that work? Well, let's take a look at the code sections. Generally, gain or loss is determined, and that's a key federal issue here, is this loss on sale, under Section 1001A, which provides a gain from the sale or disposition of property shall be the excess of the amount realized over the adjusted basis provided in Section 1011. Now, Section 1011 is the general rule for basis and tells us that the basis for determining gain or loss when we look at a partnership interest is going to be determined under Section 1012, or the applicable section of the subchapter and subchapter C or K, in this case subchapter K, adjusted as provided 1016. We're worried about the adjustments here under subchapter K. Subchapter K's adjustment to basis are generally found in Section 707, which provides that the adjusted basis of the interest of a partnership shall be except as provided in B of 707, be the basis of such interest determined under Section 722. That talks about the money going into your partnership. So I put 10,000 in. That goes up. I've got 10,000 in basis. 742 relating to transfer of the partnership interest. That is not happening here. We can ignore that provision. And we increase it by the sum of the income of the partnership, income, tax-exempt income, and excess of deduction for depletion over basis of property subject to depletion. Well, that's all nice and good. None of that happens, so we're still at our $10,000 we put in. And decrease by distributions from the partnership as provided in Section 733. And by the sum of my distributive share for the partnership taxable year and prior year of the losses and expenditures not deduct, losses of the partnership, expenditures not deductible, and then the adjustment for depletion. Well, none of those have happened, so at least arguably none of those have happened. So my basis is still $10,000. Hey, isn't this magic? So when I sell it back now for $100 because it's only worth $100 now, the partnership interest becomes a capital loss item. And this is amazing because now I can take this capital loss against my income. Now, the provisions dealing with distributions, well, maybe there was a distribution. Well, not really. It doesn't seem like there would be under the theory because Section 733. In the case of a distribution by a partnership to a partner, other than a liquidation of their interest, adjusted basis to the partner of his interest in the partnership shall be reduced, but not below zero by the amount of money distributed to such partner. We didn't get any. That's not going to change our basis. And the amount of basis to such partner of distributed property other than money determined under Section 732. Well, if you take a look under Section 732, the basis we get is kind of a carryover basis from the partnership. So even if we view the credits as being property that was distributed, the partnership had no basis in that property. Therefore, that wouldn't adjust our basis either. Hey, this thing's staying at 10 grand. Nothing's happening to it. Isn't this great? So we have magic here. The partner's interest has stayed at the 10 grand. The fair value of the partnership now has been decreased by the mere fact we allocated the only thing of value the partnership had, at least in terms of our interest, which was the credits. So our interest has dropped down to much lower number. We sell at fair value. There's no question our sale is a fair value of that interest because it's worth a lot less now that the credit's already been allocated than it was worth beforehand, before the credit was allocated. So we get a capital loss under the literal application of these provisions. And there's nothing really fancy about the application of the provisions as they discuss them. So all of these provisions are the standard provisions dealing with partnership activities. Therefore, have they discovered the miracle? Have they gotten a miracle here that will convert this into a perfectly sustainable capital loss and still get us all our money back through the state tax credits? Well, the IRS says no, and why they say no is interesting to study for a number of reasons. Because there are a number of issues here that you have to consider, some of which even have come up in practical discussions online a couple of weeks ago on the ABA tax discussion list, where we had the first IRS attack really come into play where we were discussing a potential transaction that was being discussed on that forum about a taxpayer of two partners, one of whom wanted to execute a 1031 exchange and one of whom didn't. We'll get back to that structure here in a second. Let's go here, though, for investors for the real first IRS attack, which is a substance over form attack, the IRS phrases it. But their basic position is the investors are not partners. It quotes the Supreme Court's decision in Culbertson, where the Supreme Court said the question is not whether services or capital contributed by a partner are of sufficient importance to meet some objective standard. Considering all the facts, the agreement, the conduct of the parties in execution provision, their statements of testimony, disinterested persons, the relationship of their parties, their respective abilities and capital contributions, the actual control of income and the purposes for which it is used, and any other facts throwing light on true intent, the parties in good faith and acting with a business purpose intended to join together in the present conduct of the enterprise. The IRS is asking here, did we really ever have a partnership, and what were we in partnership for, except basically on paper we claim to be in partnership? And the memorandum then analyzes the transaction and comes to the following basic conclusion. It decides there was really no business being conducted here. We didn't have individuals coming together for a business or, you know, business or type of financial interest. We didn't really have a partnership. What we had here was something other than that. The transactions were promoted as ones in which the investor would receive no material cash distributions, no net proceeds from a sale of the projects or operating partnerships, no allocation of federal income tax credit, and no partnership items of income gain, loss, or deduction. The investor subscribed to the transaction with the full knowledge that only the only benefits of entering these partnerships were the distribution of state tax credits and federal income tax losses to be claimed at the termination of their interest. Their interests were held for a relatively brief period of time. The obvious lack of joint profit motive is fatal to their classification as partners in these enterprises. Therefore, the investors were not partners in a partnership. Well, if they're not partners in the partnership, all that analysis we saw back there in the 700 series goes away, and now the question becomes, well, what do we have? And the IRS, in applying these principles to the situation, say, well, we're going to recast this using the substance over the form of the transaction. And what they say, what we really have is the transfers of the credit for cash between the builders and the investors, essentially. Direct sales and purchases of the credit, even though under state law that wasn't allowed, the IRS says we treat it as such because that's what appears to be what was really happening. It notes that this treatment applies whether or not the credit is transferable under state law and whether or not the transaction is treated as a partnership allocation for state law purposes. You know, although the credit is not transferable under state law, the transaction is a partnership allocation. In substance, basically, the builders transferred the credits to the investors for cash. The partnership LLCs generating the credit through the projects performed by the developers as partners must report gains from the sale of the credit, which have a basis of zero in the partnership's hands. We discussed that before. We had a zero basis, and now if it's viewed as an asset, we sold it. That's what the developers sell, so they have to recognize gain on that. The investors use the credit to reduce their state tax liability. They've satisfied their liability with property, resulting in a disposition under Section 1001, which would be the sale or exchange provision, but we basically exchanged it dollar for dollar our credit, so hey, we're fine. We paid off our debt with the credit. We may have gotten more or less value for the credit than we paid. You know, it depends upon, but probably we got less of a credit than we paid, or at least something in the worthwhile nature, I'd presume, depending upon our discount. And then the payments of state tax for purposes of Section 164 for the deductions. Further, the losses claimed upon the sale of the partnership interest are disallowed because effectively we didn't have anything to sell at that point, so there's nothing there. They're disallowed losses. The issue of where that entry truly exists, truly is a partnership, is a crucial one. Now let's get back to the example we were discussing online. In that case, we had a partnership that owned real estate. The two partners, you know, now they're getting ready to sell the property, and now there's a disagreement. Partner A wants to reinvest the proceeds, not recognize a gain, to a 1031 exchange, buy, you know, get a new piece of real estate. Partner B wants to go ahead and say, no. I want to take the proceeds and use the proceeds basically to invest in my, you know, invest my share of them in some other securities. And the question became, well, could we still preserve a partial 1031 exchange by having the partnership work so that, you know, partner A who wanted the real estate would be allocated everything related to the real estate from here forward, and partner B who had the marketable securities would be allocated all income loss, value changes, etc. on the securities. And the analysis question came down eventually, or a number of discussion imposed of, you know, do we have a partnership any longer? Is there any joint venture being conducted, or don't we really just have two individuals now? The problem, of course, is that we can't 1031 exchange a partnership interest. And that was one of our issues in that structure as to how we could do it. So how were we handling it and how were things working? That was our problem. That was the issue in the discussion. Again, it's an issue that you have to worry about if you truly have a partnership. And that's because, as should have noted when we discussed the early provisions, there are some very different results that occur if we do or don't have a partnership. And this was a key issue for this purpose. Now let's go on to IRS attack two. IRS on the second level said, well, even if we accept this as a partnership, the disguised sales rules, another key issue we find under Section 707, is important to consider that they believe what we have here is a disguised sale of the partnership interest. Now, Section 707A2B contains the disguised sales rules, and it provides in the code that if there is a direct or indirect transfer of money or other property by a partner to a partnership, well, in this case, the investors put their 10 grand or whatever into the partnership. There's the transfer. There is a related direct or indirect transfer of money or other property by the partnership to the partner or another partner. So now we have a transfer of property that's related to the transfer of money. The transfer is described in Clause 1 and 2 and viewed together are properly characterized as sale or exchange. Then such transfer shall be treated either as a transaction described in paragraph 1 or as a transaction between two or more partners acting in their capacity as members of the partnership. So we treat this as a transaction, basically a sales transaction. Now the key issue there, obviously, the partners put money in. The question becomes, did they receive property back? The IRS finds, looking at the regulations, that they believe, the fact is that there was a transfer of the credits. Those credits were property. And if they are viewed as property, then they will fall under the regulations because it seems to the IRS, the whole point of this was I put money in, I get credit back out. That was my relationship to the partnership. Now, we would presume the partnership would argue, oh, no, that wasn't a distribution. That was just an allocation of a partnership, of a state-level partnership item. IRS says that was a distinction without a difference. That, in fact, the only piece of property these interests had, or the only property they were interested in, was that state tax credit, which was a valuable and saleable piece of property. Outside the partnership context, clearly it was something that was being sold for cash. So it was something, it was a saleable interest and one that in a transferable status obviously would normally be considered gain or loss. So the IRS position is no, that is a transfer of property. And for that reason, the disguised sale rules would impact it. Well, what if the court won't buy either one of these? Then the IRS's third level was to say, well, if you don't like either one of those, the partnership anti-abuse regulation found at regulation section 1.701-2 covers this transaction. Now that's an important reg. We've talked about it before. That is a very important regulation when you're dealing with an issue of a benefit that is being received because we have a partnership structure. Regulation 1.701-2 is the IRS's broad brush rule that allows the IRS, if they feel you don't properly reflect the intent of subchapter K as viewed by the IRS, to reclassify your transaction in some other form. And the regulation starts out by telling us what is the intent of subchapter K. And this is found at Regulation 1.701-2A. And that tells us subchapter K is intended to permit taxpayers to conduct joint business, including investment activities, through a flexible economic arrangement without incurring an anti-level tax. Implicit in the intent of subchapter K are the following requirements. The partnership must be bona fide, and each partnership transaction or series of related transactions, individually or collectively the transaction for this term, must be entered into for a substantial business purpose. The form of each partnership transaction must be respected under substance over form principles, and except as provided in paragraph A3, The tax consequences under Subchapter K to each partner of the partnership operations of transactions between the partner and the partnership must accurately reflect the partner's economic agreement and clearly reflect the partner's income. Now, they go on to say, certain provisions of Subchapter K in the regulations were adopted to promote administrative convenience and other policy objectives with the recognition that application of these provisions could, in some circumstances, produce tax results that do not properly reflect income. Thus, the proper reflection of income requirement of this paragraph we're discussing is treated as satisfied with respect to a transaction that satisfies A1 or 2 of these sections. That was when it said the bonafide partnership and recognizing, respecting the substance over form principles, the form of the transaction. To the extent the application of such provisions, transaction, ultimate tax results, taking into account all the relative facts and circumstances, are clearly contemplated by that provision. So it says if we have a provision that doesn't result in a clear reflection of income, but it's clear the code intended that to be the result, then that's okay. Otherwise, it's a problem. If the partnership does not comply with the intent, then what can the IRS do? Well, if you look at section 1.701-2B, you're going to find that, according to the IRS, if in fact they decide your partnership does not meet the intent of subchapter K test, they can do any of the following. They can disregard the partnership in whole or part, and the assets should be considered owned in whole or part by the individuals respectively, or one or more of the purported partners. That one or more of the partners will not be treated as a partner, that they can change the method of accounting, or they can basically reallocate items of income, gain, loss, or deduction. Or finally, if none of that covers it, they say the claim tax treatment should be otherwise adjusted or modified. So essentially, once the IRS has basically gone over the hurdle of, well, you fail the intent of subchapter K, they claim basically a carte blanche right to reallocate everything. As you might expect, the IRS analysis decides that this structure does not meet the intent, and so they have the authority under Reg 1.701-2B to recast the transaction, basically as we were described under substance over form. Now, the IRS had two reasons why the transaction did not meet the intent of subchapter K, and this may sound a little redundant because it sounds a lot like the initial description we had for the initial reason that we didn't work. And basically over the substance over form doctrine, and they weren't a partner. Well, we're going to go back to virtually a very similar detail. Our first attack is that the partnerships were used for the specific purpose of allocating the credit to the investors, resulting in a substantial federal tax reduction. The use of the partnership form enabled the promoters of the transaction to effect the sale of large numbers of credits at a profit per dollar of credit without incurring gain at any level. Moreover, by design, the investors claim large amounts of capital losses from the sale of their interest to the promoters at a fraction of their basis. These manufactured deductions effectively substituted for state tax payments the investors could not otherwise benefit from, typically because such payments would not have been deductible for AMT purposes. Additionally, the partnerships failed to make 754 election, therefore had inflated inside bases. This use of the partnership form is inconsistent with the intent of subchapter K, which is to permit taxpayers to conduct joint business activity through a flexible economic arrangement without incurring an entity-level tax. So based on that analysis, number one, they claim we meet the test. Then they said, second, if you don't like that, we have another problem. The promoters and investors entered into various subscription agreement, option agreements, and partnership agreements for the allocation and gainful disposition of state tax credits in anticipation of reporting no gain and claiming large losses for federal tax purposes. Tax avoidance, therefore, was a principal purpose behind the use of the partnerships. So the fact was they were available upon basically, principally, or we might even say solely for the purpose of getting a tax benefit, also violates the intent of subchapter K. So the IRS analyzes what would happen, and the result's a lot like we saw in the first case. Guess what? We should apply this regulation to disregard those partnerships, recast the transactions, and basically the transactions should be treated as ones in which promoters purchase credits from the developers at X dollars per dollar of credit, sold them to individuals at C dollars per dollar of credit. As the partnerships are disregarded, the losses claimed by the individual investors for their sales of the partnership interest are disallowed. So they're getting us back to the first result again, saying we ignore this, we have a sale of these interests. So under all three scenarios, the IRS comes to the conclusion that what we have is a sale of credit just like we had any year before, same treatment as when we had a sale of a credit before, and there's no capital loss on disposition of the asset. Now, the IRS goes on to analyze whether these are, whether it's a partnership item for purposes of TEFRA and examination. We're not going to deal with that issue today. The real issue here is a reminder of the various ways Subchapter K interacts with us, and not just in the tax shelter arena. It's important to remember that many of the provisions we discussed, even the provisions that the promoters tried to use, do apply and have legitimate uses, not only legitimate, but required usage in an actual partnership. So be aware that some unusual results that are very different from what we see in other types of entities occur in a partnership structure. As well, the specific situation here is a bit unique. You know, the methods have shown up before in other shelter structures. Because of Subchapter K's flexibility, because of the very unique things that happen to basis in Subchapter K and in a partnership, when assets move in and out of the partnership, there are really some opportunities, shall we say, that promoters of shelters have found for the years to make use of that basis shifting to gain certain advantages. But it's important to note that if you don't have a shelter structure, you just have a run-of-the-mill partnership, that same basis shifting takes place, and that basis shifting may be good, bad, or indifferent, but it's important to recognize that it exists and it will take place. This is different from if you were incorporated. Now, another issue the IRS did not consider, but which likely is important. It would seem that the state in question might also raise an issue about whether these partnerships were legitimate partnerships or whether they were not, in fact, vehicles to sell the credit, in which case, since the state legislature, we would presume, had decided sales of credits wasn't a good idea, is not just an attempted in-run around the rule of the legislature, and therefore it might be invalidated at the state level. It would be clear a taxpayer considering to get into an enterprise like this or a structure like this needs good independent counsel, not counsel coming from someone promoting the shelter, but independent counsel related to the viability of this partnership investment. Note that getting good independent counsel has proven to be very important in a number of cases when we deal with penalties and taxpayers escaping penalties based upon such independent advice. It would be very useful to remind your clients when they hear something too good to be true of those cases that have told us how important it is to have somebody who doesn't stand to gain or lose by whether you go forward with the transaction, take a look at and give an opinion on the transaction, as opposed to just accepting the marketing materials of the promoters, which amazingly tend to come down usually and tell us this is all going to work. And that was a key issue that we were taking a look at in this particular structure, would be whether, in fact, we get any benefit even on the state level. And that's something that would have to be judged against the state law requirements. Now, this has been the Tax Update for Saturday, February the 24th, 2007. Tax Update, as always, is brought to you by Limeburg Information Services, located on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. You can visit them online to check out their information available for tax practitioners and take a look at the various newsletters they offer. This week, Paul Hood had a very interesting commentary toward the end of the week discussing a ruling involving a charitable remainder trust that also went into an important concept about whether advisors properly considered their clients' expectations or their clients' preferences, which was a key issue involving this CRUT, as to whether or not the preferences of the client had really been respected or whether, which unfortunately I've seen happen more than once, it appears that the advisor may have made his own decision about what the client's goal was rather than really having the client have a full understanding of what they wanted. The key issue in question was the taxpayers ended up with a NIMCRUT. The taxpayers now say, "Ooh, wait, we're not getting any net. There's no net income in this CRUT. We want to get our payments every year." And now they're trying to get it reformed. The state court said it was fine as long as you got a ruling from the IRS, a letter ruling that said it was fine. The IRS refused to provide that, said, no, we're ruling against you. So the key question becomes making sure that the client truly understands how the transaction would work. I will also point out, since clients tend to hear what they want to hear, it's probably best to make sure that you put such agreements or such explanations down in writing. That has two advantages. Number one, it serves as a record of what you told them, But number two, when it's in writing, that's a signal to the client that this is an important something going on, and then they can read it over, and you may find that when they're away from the meeting and suddenly they, you know, they're no longer thinking, oh yeah, look what a wonderful tax result, and they sit down and read the document, they may suddenly say, well, does that mean what I think it means? And the answer is, well, yes, it means if it doesn't make any income, you don't get any payment. And that was the problem these taxpayers ran into. Again, that's the type of useful advice and newsletters you get, so take a look at those if you subscribe to the services or consider subscribing to them. This has been the Tax Update for Saturday, February the 24th, 2007.